Welcome to Season 1 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with disability leaders each week about career, life, and technology. I'm Sam Prue.
And I'm Nikki Nolan.
Let's get started.
Would you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Elise Roy. My pronouns are she and her. I am a principal architect at Salesforce, and I have short brown hair, glasses, 40 or so, hate to admit that, and I am currently wearing a sweater. In my background, I am in my office, and I have books in the background on the shelves and some pictures up. And there's a blue wall behind me.
To get started, we would love to learn, what made you change from being a lawyer to a designer?
That's a great question. I think it all comes down to learning more about myself. I knew that I love advocacy and the ability to do good. I like the intellectual challenge that the law brought and the deep thinking, but I hated the day-to-day stuff. It was dry, it was boring, there wasn't much room for creativity. And as a kid, I had always thought that I had wanted to be a designer, but I kind of got taken into the legal realm due to some of the advocacy work that I had been doing. Anyways, I was in Zambia at the time, and I was 29 when I was making this decision, and I realized that people were expected to live there to be just 34 years old. And that kind of hit home to me that life is short. So I decided to make that transition to design.
Was there pressure for you to go into law? I know sometimes as people with disabilities, we can be pressured into careers where other people think that we are successful. And did you experience that pressure as you were growing up and making your career choices?
Yeah, I was definitely pressured to go into law by my grandfather. He was always all about getting a license for something. And so he really pressured me to go into the legal realm. But in terms of my disability, I think how that influenced things was that people saw me as a disability advocate, and it made sense to pursue a legal degree to support that.
Interesting. The other question I have about that journey is the law can be very focused on compliance, right? We need to comply with accessibility law. We need to comply with diversity and inclusion. Did you find it hard when you moved from the law into design to move away from thinking about compliance and about legal requirements and thinking more creatively, or did that come naturally to you?
When I went into the law, I found that my writing kind of became really dry and boring, whereas before it was more creative. And I did struggle to get that back after leaving the law. So there's definitely something there. I think that being a designer definitely allows me to bring more creativity to trying to solve problems and to ask better questions. I'm working within user experience, and that's rooted in getting user feedback and being humble enough to know that we don't have all the answers, and being a better listener. So it's really made me flex those listening skills, the curiosity skills, the questioning skills, and making sure that I'm keeping myself honest, you know, that I'm not jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, I think that that's something that's really, really interesting that happens. Sometimes we come in with this preconceived notion of what the solution to a problem without fundamentally understanding what is the problem because we haven't listened enough. So this sort of leads into my next question. What are some of those issues that arise when people approach a problem with a preconceived solution?
Yeah, so a lot of problems arise. I think this is what we saw early in tech before we had user experience, you know, as a part of the development process. We had engineers who were so used to this tech and thought that they were designing intuitive experiences, working to create those experiences. But then they realize, you know, not everybody has the mind of an engineer. And so it's really important to make sure that we aren't like approaching problems with preconceived solutions. We need to recognize that we aren't the experts here. The users are the experts. And, you know, I also experienced that in terms of the disability realm, and not just in terms of product design, but when I was a lawyer and working at the UN, what was unique about that process of writing the UN treaty that protected the rights of people with disabilities was they actually, for the first time, made sure that they involved people with disabilities in the process of creating that treaty. But I remember for the first time being exposed to the concept, nothing but us without us. And that really recognized that, you know, we need to have the voice of the people that we are designing this policy for integrated into this process, because they understand their true needs and they can articulate them so that we can write a policy that truly addresses the problems that they're faced with. And so that's what I see as also applying to the user experience space that we're in now.
It was also interesting to me when you said that users are the experts, because I immediately thought of one place where design without users is still happening. And that tends to be in, unfortunately, some advocacy organizations. In the blind community, for example, there is a massive problem with people who have no experience wanting to redesign canes and other things. Is that a problem for you and in the deaf community? And how does that impact you and what you do?
So yeah, the deaf community is really trying to protect their voice. And that's why they've really advocated very strongly for their, say, president of Gallaudet University to be someone who is deaf. The people who are representing them actually be deaf, because they recognize that in order to solve for something that they experience, their voice and understanding that experience is vital to solving it.
It's so frustrating, isn't it, that this is something we have to fight for rather than it being the assumed norm, that of course you should be represented by people who are part of your community.
It's interesting hearing, because all three of us have different disabilities. And so it's really, really interesting to see how segregated our communities become because of our needs not being met by society. So we have to become insulated, because there's a lot of people who think that they do have solutions without lived experience. I know that in the autism community as well, there are organizations that are run by non-autistic people that are very damaging. And so I think that the disability space is a really interesting space. So I think I'm going to transition us from a lot of the stuff I've seen. You are really into design thinking. What do you feel is the power of design thinking?
It's powerful in terms of framing problems that we're dealing with, making sure that we are framing the right problem. And it's powerful also in terms of helping you see patterns within data, and really helps us think outside the box.
Just realize not everyone's going to know what design thinking is. Like, what is design thinking?
There's many different definitions. There's human-centered design, there's design thinking, and then it all intersects somewhat with user, what we do with user experience. And so we often use design thinking in solving the problems that we're dealing with. It's basically including the users, but it's also a process of like going wide and then coming in narrow and using various design methods and techniques and exercises to help us do that, to help us think deeper about the user, to help us bring the insights that we're gathering. But it also pretty much follows a pretty typical design process of, you know, defining the problem and then ideating and then designing and doing some prototyping and testing it with the users and getting feedback. And it's circular.
I love design thinking. It's the way that as soon as I came across design thinking, all of a sudden everything sort of snapped in my brain like, oh yeah, like this is the way I already think, but now there's a framework. And I do find that a lot of people ignore the first step, which is like define and discover or research. And they jump straight to, I know what the problem is. I'm going to start making the solution. And yeah.
I think Gottborn, the best thing about design thinking is that they immediately recognize we don't know what the problem is. You know, they want you to throw out many ideas, not just focus on one, and, you know, explore those. And that allows us to get a little bit more creative, think outside box and so forth.
There is a fear in some companies that design thinking and especially inclusive design and being inclusive will slow things down and companies won't be able to keep up the rapid speed of movement that they feel that they need to. How do you respond to that fear?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that I've encountered. And while there tends to be more upfront time in inclusive design, the ROI from inclusive design is astronomical in comparison. And so ultimately you make up for that time that you might invest up front. And what I see within inclusive design is because you're starting and innovating with edge users or stress cases, you're immediately starting to build in adaptability into your products and working to fit in the diverse needs that everybody has across the world, you know, that you have to solve for, especially if you're a global company. And so when you start there, rather than average and building out slowly to meet those diverse needs, you jump ahead in that innovation process. And that's where the value is in terms of inclusive design.
There is also cost to retrofitting designs, right? Mm. We talk about how it costs 10% to do it right of what it would cost to retrofit. And we talk about the finances of that. But I think retrofitting existing designs also has an effect on the designer, right? Have you had to retrofit a product or a design that didn't take accessibility into account? And if so, what was that experience like? Was it more stressful for you? Was it less pleasurable to have to refit an existing thing to be accessible to more people?
Oh, what that tends to do is exactly as you said. It tends to frustrate people. It tends to make it that much more time that you have to take to get people on board, to find the people who may have been doing that code that, you know, we were working on and maybe it's gone when they don't understand how to change that code and everything else that's involved. And then it could also be affecting the way that users interact with something, which could also involve education as well that you have to solve for in the future. And so there's so much that goes into the retrofitting. There's frustrations on all ends, from engineers to designers to the product managers. So for sure, if you can avoid having to retrofit, if you can think about accessibility and inclusive design and design in from the start, then you save frustration, time, all of that, lots of money.
So while we're talking about frustration, why don't we segue into what has been kind of the biggest frustration in your career, and is it still happening?
So this is still happening sometimes, but it's getting better and better. And that's designing for disability as something that's an add-on. That's something that we should just do because we're doing good, rather than recognizing that, well, yes, it's doing good, but it's also about the huge value that the unique perspective of people with disabilities brings to our development process. When we do inclusive design, we're bringing them in, we're talking with them, and we're learning from their experiences with difference and learning about opportunities in our design to make them more innovative that and make them more user-friendly for all users. And we're learning how to make our products more intuitive. We're learning how to simplify them, to make them more adaptable to different experiences that people might be momentarily experiencing. So, you know, this goes back to the fact that we all experience disability at one time that in our life, at different times in our lives. We might be holding something in our arms, a package or something, and in that moment, we have only the use of one arm. And so we are similar to somebody who might have an amputation. And so all of that, though, designing for those differences and different situations and disability means that we're designing adaptability into our experiences and really making sure that we are meeting the diverse needs that users might have.
Yeah, I think you touched on something interesting about situational disability. Can you explain situational disability to people who might not understand what situational disability is?
There's really three types of disabilities that exist and that we like to think about in terms of inclusive design. There's permanent disabilities, which is disability that somebody lives with day in, day out, 24/7, death. That's one example of a permanent disability. Then there's temporary disabilities. Those are disabilities where we might have for a limited amount of time. So we might break our wrists and have to wear a cast for a couple of weeks or a couple of months. And so we are temporarily disabled, but eventually we'll heal. Then there's situational disabilities. And that's when we are in certain situations, the environment of that situation makes us momentarily have a disability. Example that I gave was that we might be holding something in our arms. And that situation is just essentially the same as someone who has mobility issues in their arms.
And that, of course, there's also age-related disability, right? Disability is the only identity that everyone is going to take on at some point in their lives, very probably. Sort of leads into something else, which is that I strongly, and I suspect you agree, that people with disabilities can't be a charity, right? It's if it's social good, it's just for charitable reasons. And there are more important reasons than that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's my frustration is when people still think of this as charitable good, like doing charitable good. I'm hoping instead that we are slowly shifting people to see the value of difference, how that is valuable and helping us think outside the box, valuable in different ways of experiencing life and enjoying it and the diversity that comes up with it. You know, some of my most interesting friends are people with disabilities. I have a friend who has no internal voice and is on the spectrum. And I can't stop asking her questions because it's just so fascinating to me to try and think about what her world is like.
Yeah. Absolutely. Before we get to our next question, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Lynette. I'm the community manager at Fable. I'm also a full-time screen reader user. And before becoming the community manager, I started out as a member of our community of accessibility testers. Now I help build and support the community of assistive technology users that powers everything we do here at Fable. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your accessibility journey. Fable can help you do that. From improving your team's accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage, we can help you take the next step on your accessibility journey. To learn more, please check out our website at makeitfable.com.
And with that, We're back. Let's get on with the interview.
Let's jump into what has been your biggest success.
I don't see it necessarily as like my biggest success, but something that I'm proud of in terms of the impact it had was the TED Talk that I gave. After that talk, I was so humbled and so in awe that I'd heard from people from all of the world who had taken that message and implemented it. And it motivated them to create businesses, to create different products, to make all sorts of change that happened. And so that was really, really something that I feel so grateful to be given that opportunity to give the TED Talk and also to have these wonderful, fabulous individuals who put in that sweat, amplified that message and created some incredible things from it.
Yeah, it was a fantastic talk. So I'm really curious, what are some myths around disability that you want to bust?
Is disability necessarily a bad thing, a negative thing? I think it depends on how you frame it. In terms of neurodiversity, for example, or ADHD, it's a skill that we really need. And it often leads to unprecedented innovation. There's some pretty famous innovators out there who had ADHD, Richard Branson, I think, and some others who have really changed the world because they're able to take this kind of like, I think of it as a Speedy Gonzales perspective, right? When they can go through information really quick and then create this framework and see these connections that others might not see. And so it really depends on how you frame disability, also in terms of deafness. What would happen if we all spoke in sign language? Would I have a disability? It's really society that's making my disability in many ways. And we've also found that people who are raised learning sign language actually have a more developed right side of their brain. And so they tend to be better on right side brain functions. And so it's pretty fascinating to see.
We're getting really close to the end, and we love to end with this. Like, super curious, what was the first piece of technology you remember using, and what was it for?
One of the most impactful first, not first, but like early technologies is email. When I used email, that was just life altering. It felt as if my social life opened up more. Because before I went to school where people lived far away and it was hard, I couldn't talk to people on the phone. Mm. And so email allowed me to connect with my friends much more easier and to keep in touch and to develop a deeper relationship, to check in on homework, all of that I had missed before. So that was really a huge, huge change for me and also built up my confidence as well.
Yeah, it's similar for different reasons. One feeling that I remember clearly is that for the time it became possible to email back and forth with someone and have them not know that you are a person with a disability. Did you have that experience as well? Was that impactful for you?
Yeah, it sort of leveled the playing field in many ways, for sure. That, and then now the captioning, the auto-captioning on these meetings that we have, Zoom and Google Meet, that is something similar to that, just kind of levels the playing field for me. I'm not sure how I would have really functioned at the level I do through this pandemic. If I didn't have access to captioning for me.
Okay, what's really interesting for me is that for my disability, when we moved to a more text-based thing, being dyslexic, all of a sudden people saw my disability. So I think that's really, it's just really interesting to see like the diversity within us all and like how it was really uplifting for both of you and for me having to move to a text-based was so confidence diminishing. Like for me, to the point where now that we work remotely and we're working mostly through a lot of text-based mediums, but I feel less confident in my abilities. It's really, it's interesting.
I hear you. And that's something that I keep seeing and getting to sometimes is in the evolution of technology, we all of a sudden start including one type of disability and then excluding another disability as we like continue to evolve. And that's why it's so important to make sure that we design a variety of ways to access that same experience.
Yeah.
Flexibility is so critical. And I think there is sometimes a tendency, I don't know if you agree with this or not, and I'll be to find out. I think there's a tendency of society to play people with disabilities off against each other. If a thing is captioned, there's no longer money to describe it, or to people think that their needs will conflict in ways that be overcome. Have you noticed that? And how do you handle it and respond to it if you have?
That's a great observation. Definitely, I've noticed people struggling to include and make an experience kind of as inclusive as possible. And I think there, what you hit on is the difference between universal design and inclusive design. Universal design is trying to design one thing to be as inclusive as possible for as many people with disabilities as possible. And inclusive design instead takes the approach, can we design a variety of ways to access this experience? So it might not be building in that functionality into one single source, but instead looking at a variety of ways to do that.
This has been so much fun. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I've loved this conversation, but it is an ongoing conversation and there is more work to do. So if people would like to learn more, if people would like to continue the conversation, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn under my name, Elise Roy, and also on Twitter at Elise Roy. So please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from people and hearing all of, I think it's so important to hear from different people because those different perspectives are really what enriches things for me, enriches my own practice and design and user experience.
Thanks so much.
This has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan, edited by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. The theme music is created by F.A. Achman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable, who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram at Disability Bandwidth or on our website, disabilitybandwidth.com. Thanks for listening.